From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, leaving Iraq more intelligently than we entered. That's the goal of some top military strategists, according to Tom Ricks. He's the Washington Post military correspondent and the author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. We'll talk about the exit strategies he learned about interviewing military strategists during his recent trip to Iraq. The military has a shortage of translators who know Arabic. One of those translators, Stephen Benjamin, was recently discharged because he's gay. He'll tell us his Don't Ask, Don't Tell story. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tom Ricks, is military correspondent for The Washington Post and the author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, which will be published in paperback at the end of July. In the book, he wrote, the U.S.-led invasion was launched recklessly with a flawed plan for war and a worse approach to the occupation. Ricks's latest trip to Iraq was at the end of May. He spent time in the Green Zone and at Camp Victory's army base west of Baghdad. His goal was to find out what senior military leaders were thinking. He told me that he spent most of his time in the Green Zone as the result of what he describes as a ceasefire agreement with his wife. After he was nearly killed in an ambush in Iraq in 2004, his wife asked him not to go back. The compromise they reached was that he'd stay in the protected, walled-in Green Zone. But from what I've been reading, it sounds like even the Green Zone isn't safe anymore.
The Green Zone is extraordinarily safe compared to the rest of Baghdad. I was there when some mortars and rockets were landing outside. And the mortar it's not as scary as a weapon as people think. It has a fairly small lethal blast radius. And so we were sitting inside. We just sort of continued our conversation. And all the diplomats were getting kind of frenzied. We're being rocketed. We're being mortared. And the soldiers were kind of laughing, which is sort of welcome to the war, fellas. You know, this is what you put up with when you're out on any base anywhere in Iraq all the time. So I didn't feel particularly threatened. The thing about the Green Zone that really struck me this time is I used to hate going into the Green Zone because it was just the sea of nonsense. People would sit there and blather and tell you about what's going on in Iraq. And I used to get kind of surety, which I don't like to do as a reporter. I remember saying to a general, "General, please go outside the Green Zone and walk a mile in civilian clothes. You won't survive." And he didn't believe me. The tone in the Green Zone really has changed from the last time I was there, which is in early 2006. It really is much more sober, much more realistic. I think the officials there in their understanding of Iraq, much more tolerant of ambiguity. I remember a guy telling me in some of the discussions they're having with insurgent leaders, you don't need to endorse the American position. You don't need to support us. All you need to do is agree to stop killing Iraqi civilians, Iraqi security forces, and American troops. Can you do that? And that's much more flexible position than they used to have.
Well, one of the things that you reported from Iraq is that one of the guiding principles for military officials in Iraq now is that the U.S. should leave Iraq more intelligently than it entered Iraq. So what kind of exit strategy is that translating into?
There's a huge focus on that issue right now in the Green Zone. And I think their starting point is a real frustration with where the debate is in the United States at this point, a feeling that the debate on both sides of the equation over the war back here has become quite sterile and not really realistic. And what they're saying on the ground is, look, you're not going to get out of Iraq overnight, nor can you continue at the current force levels. There simply aren't enough American troops to continue the current counteroffensive, the so-called surge, beyond March of next year. So they're saying we need to think about different courses of action. And they want to push the debate back here a bit so when the Congress starts debating Iraq again in September, it gets beyond the support the war or don't support the war, but talk seriously, whether or not you support the war, about what the next step is. looking at the realities of the ground in Iraq and the region. And so that's kind of where they're at, thinking about where we go in 2008 and trying to get beyond what they see as the false dilemma of the all or nothing debate back here.
So what is there in between the all or nothing debate?
Well, their beginning point is even if the U.S. Congress and the president told us to leave Iraq, it would take us 12 to 18 months to do so entirely.
Why?
Because you'd have thousands of convoys, and you could only put so many convoys on that one road down to Kuwait to get U.S. troops and to get U.S. equipment out. I can't remember the exact number, but it was, you know, if you did 30 convoys a day of 200 vehicles, which are large convoys, it would take something like 10 months to get all U.S. equipment out. So even if you were told tomorrow morning to leave, it would take a long time. The second point is, when they say, let's leave Iraq more intelligently than we came in, is let's think seriously about consequences. Let's not just plan according to American hopes and assumptions, but actually dealing with the realities of the situation. Can you cut deals with Iraqis in such a way that even Iraqis who are against the occupation could somehow live with a smaller American presence? There, when they talk about that, they're especially thinking of Muqtadir al-Sadr, the radical Shiite cleric, who I think in many ways is the big winner in post-Saddam Iraq. Now, here's a guy who 2 years ago was a declared enemy of the United States, whose Mahdi army killed many U.S. troops. And they're kind of quietly reaching out and saying, we know you don't like the occupation, but we bet you actually would like a U.S. presence. We could draw down the troop level so it doesn't feel like an occupation anymore. But there's still going to be Sunni insurgents here who want to kill you and stop your government. So wouldn't you like to have a residual U.S. presence? And so you begin with that point, okay, maybe a small combat force to guarantee the security of what is necessarily going to be a Shiite government in Baghdad. Okay, well then they're going to need logistics forces, supply forces. They're going to need a headquarters, command and control, intelligence, communications. Okay, and then you're going to have a training and advisory force, and you're going to need to be able to protect them in case they get in trouble either with insurgents or with security forces that mutiny against them. And so you start talking about maybe a force of 40,000 troops. When you start talking about that, what they're really talking about is a force for the next American president to say, whoever becomes president in January 2009, here is what we think is a long-term force for Iraq.
How long-term?
My personal bet, and I thought this when I was writing Fiasco, is we're going to have combat troops in Iraq for 10 to 15 years.
And what do the military leaders in Iraq who you spoke to think the consequences would be if we did a complete pullout? Say it took a year to do it, but if we did a complete U.S. troop pullout, what would that mean?
Their eyes get big at the thought. There's a consensus that you probably would trigger a full-blown civil war in Iraq, which you don't have at this point. What you have now is sort of a low-level chronic civil war. You would have ethnic cleansing of a quite violent sort that would probably clean all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and result in three armed camps, a Kurdish armed camp, a Sunni armed camp, and a Shiite armed camp. And effectively, you would have a regional civil war fought out in the streets of Baghdad and around that city.
But, you know, the attitude of some Americans is, well, we gave the Iraqis a chance. You know, we liberated them, got rid of Saddam Hussein, and, you know, helped them write a constitution. But they just have let everything fall apart. They're fighting among each other. Their government is non-functional. At this point, it's their fault. And if they can't get it together, why should we suffer? So let's pull out all of our troops.
Yeah, this is what I call freaking Iraqis. You know, we did everything for them. And what a bunch of ingrates. My feeling about that is a little bit like amputating a guy's legs at the knees and then saying, look, we gave you a new pair of sneakers. Why aren't you running any faster? We did a lot to mess up Iraq through inattention, through operating on false assumptions, and through a kind of official optimism that pervaded both the Bush administration and the U.S. military for several years. We've abandoned most of that official optimism, at least among American officials on the ground in Iraq. Part of this new sobriety, I think, among American officials is recognizing quite what a mess we created there. And so I think they're trying to also express a moral responsibility. that we have made allies of a lot of Iraqis. And if you just walk out of there, they are likely to be slaughtered. Another problem is if we make it clear we're leaving altogether, people are going to need to establish their anti-U.S. street cred. And one way they do that is by attacking Americans. So you might see an avalanche of anti-American attacks among people who now need to establish that they really have been anti-American all along.
You write that one argument for maintaining a small U.S. combat force in Iraq is to deter foreign intervention. And I was wondering, like, who are you thinking of?
Well, you already have a lot of foreign intervention in Iraq. In some ways, you are seeing the outlines of this regional civil war already occurring in the streets of Baghdad. There's a strong Iranian presence in Iraq, especially in Baghdad and in the south. Other countries are also players: Syria, Saudi Arabia. The Turks are being very demonstrative and noisy about their unhappiness with Kurdish terrorists operating out of Iraq and carrying out attacks on Turkish soil. And that's especially an interesting problem because Turkey is a member of NATO, and we are committed to defend it. We also are committed to defending Iraq. And if Turkey defends Iraq, we essentially have one ally attacking another one. And I'm not quite sure where we wind up in that. Where it's tactically very worrisome is some of the best Iraqi army forces on the streets of Baghdad are actually Kurds, Peshmerga forces. And I think if Kurdistan were attacked by the Turks, a lot of those Kurds, probably most of them, would leave Baghdad and go home to defend their homeland. So a Turkish attack up north, which the Turks say could happen any time, could really affect what General Petraeus is trying to do on the ground in Baghdad with his security plan.
My guest is Tom Ricks, the military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. It will be published in paperback at the end of July. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Ricks. He's the military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, and it comes out in paperback at the end of July. American forces have started a new offensive against al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, and that's a radical group. I'm going to ask you to explain who they are, but what gets really confusing here is that in this new offensive against al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, we're working with Sunni groups that oppose this group, but this group is a Sunni group, so it's... Why don't you explain some of the cast of characters here, because this is the kind of civil war that gets really confusing. It's not like there's just two sides.
The dividing lines in a lot of the Muslim world are between tribal loyalties and religious beliefs. And frequently what you get is the old line social structure of tribalism being opposed by young firebrand religious clerics. The Taliban, for example, in Afghanistan, in many ways are an anti-tribal force, even though they are based in one tribe, the Pashtuns. Likewise, in Iraq, what you're seeing now is tribes saying, we are really sick of getting pushed around by al-Qaeda, and we want to fight them. At least that's what they're telling the Americans. And to some degree they are, by making Anbar province in the west of Iraq especially inhospitable to al-Qaeda. They're forcing al-Qaeda in Iraq to move to other parts of the country, especially what they call the belt around Baghdad, especially north of Baghdad, west of Baghdad, and northeast of Baghdad. My worry about this is it's not clear to me what the motivations of some of those tribal sheikhs really are. I suspect that what some of the tribes are doing is saying, you know, Uncle Sam is probably serious about leaving Iraq in some way, or at least getting out of being in the middle of this low-level civil war. And so we better get some of that arming and training stuff that the Shiites are getting, because we're going to be facing a hostile Shiite government in Baghdad. And so this is a way for the tribes to arm themselves and also for the tribal militias to be legitimized by dealing with Uncle Sam. And so in some ways, what we think is a unalloyed good, tribes turning against al-Qaeda, may simply be preparatory maneuvers for the full-blown civil war that they see happening after we reduce our presence next year.
What exactly are we doing for them? Training them? Arming them?
First of all, we're talking to them, which we didn't used to do. We're tolerating them. We're allowing them to operate as long as they say they're against al-Qaeda. For a long time, we've been saying no armed militias, that they're illegitimate. The state must have a monopoly on the use of violence in this country. We've essentially abandoned that position, and we are now saying, knock yourselves out, fellas. If you want to fight al-Qaeda, we'll help you out. We might arm you. We'll give you intelligence. We have a lot of little UAVs on unmanned aerial vehicles operating overhead that can give you good photographs. And sometimes these militias are saying things like, if we lead you to an arms cache, can we keep the arms? And sometimes the commanders say, sure, as long as they're not heavy weapons. And so these guys are getting some stuff that they know about and arming themselves.
So in some ways, haven't we armed and trained various sides in what is now a civil war?
Yeah, we may very well have. This is the big bet that we're placing right now, is this won't all go sour on us, the letting the tribes operate their militias. This is another thing that I think really characterizes the American effort in Iraq right now as very different from the last 4 years. There's a new mood of risk-taking. As one general said to me, again and again in Iraq, we failed to make the tough choices over the last 4 years. What we didn't recognize is when you don't make a tough choice, somebody else makes it for you. So we pretended that we were a neutral entity between the Sunnis and the Shiites, when really everybody knew that we actually were enabling the Shiites to take control of the country. Talking to the sheikhs and letting their militias operate against al-Qaeda is another form of risk-taking. But when you take a risk, there's an upside and a downside. And the downside is we are simply creating the conditions for a really horrible civil war that after we pull out from being in the middle of all this sometime next year.
Are there dissidents in the military who think that this strategy might pose the kind of problems that you're describing?
Yeah, there's a lot of dissidents in the military. The so-called surge, with basically a troop increase of about 28,000 troops over the course of 6 months, there was a lot of dissent among generals about this surge. Top generals opposed it, some of them, including Lieutenant General Lute, who was just appointed the new war czar at the White House to coordinate the war effort back here, said in his confirmation testimony that he had real doubts about this counteroffensive. What it really does is run counter to the U.S. military view for the last 4 years, held by General Abizaid, who was the head of Central Command, and by General Casey, the top general on the ground in Iraq, that U.S. forces were a negative presence in Iraqi society, that the friction caused by their simply being seen encouraged anti-Americanism and pushed people towards supporting the insurgency. That view has now been repudiated by General Petraeus, and he's pushing troops off the big isolated bases and out into small combat outposts across Baghdad. Last time I looked, there are about 66 of these. They're small, they're out in the neighborhoods, and yes, they are vulnerable. I think the insurgents would love to attack one of those outposts and destroy the building and wipe out all the American troops inside it.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this new strategy of moving troops off the large isolated bases and into smaller and therefore more vulnerable outposts. The reason for that is so that the troops kind of mix more with the people? Like, what is the larger philosophy?
Well, if you go back to Mao, one of the great counterinsurgency theorists, or insurgency theorist in his case, he said the guerrilla swims in the sea of the people. And our problem was we weren't out in the sea of the people at all. We essentially did patrols off these big bases. It would take 90 minutes to do wherever they're going to do the patrol. They do the patrol for a couple hours, and then they go back to their big base and say, job well done. What that meant was you were present in a neighborhood for 90 minutes out of 24 hours. And the other 22 and a half hours of the day, the neighborhood was a wholly owned subsidiary of the insurgency. What they're saying is get your troops out there. Make it so they have a feel for the ground. They know what normal looks like. They know who's supposed to be there. They start picking up intelligence, especially when they work side by side with Iraqis who speak the language and can talk to people. And somebody can say, you know, that car over there, that came from Fallujah last night. That's not one of us. That's the theory. The amazing thing is the U.S. military operated in Iraq for 4 years while ignoring this key aspect of counterinsurgency theory that the troops must be out among the people.
Do you have any sense of how the soldiers feel about this? Because they're the ones who are going to be more vulnerable.
Soldiers essentially are just trying to get through this thing. What they're focused on is keeping them and their buddies alive and not getting bombed. I think at this point they're willing to try it, most of them, out of the feeling that, look, if we tried everything else, it didn't work, we might as well try this. But with each tour, I do think that the cynicism about it grows somewhat. One tone I've picked up recently that has surprised me is the feeling of some soldiers, and I think it's still a minority feeling, of being a pawn of American politics. What exactly are we doing here? Why are we doing this? Why is everything we're doing seemingly linked to the presidential election in 2008?
So your feelings, you're getting this kind of reaction more than ever before, that it's politically motivated?
Yeah, it's still distinctly, I think, a minority feeling. Morale, I think, continues to be surprisingly high, given what a long, difficult war this is. But I think there is a little bit more of a ground-down feeling I'm seeing among troops on their third tours in Iraq. And even the most optimistic officials in Baghdad are certainly not saying this thing is going to work. They're saying it's worth a risk. Let's take a gamble. Let's try it. But I remember one official saying to me, look, Tom, you're asking a lot of questions. He said, I can summarize this whole thing for you in 10 words. And I said, okay. And he said, bottom line, right people, right strategy, too little, too late.
Tom Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post and the author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From American Express, whose special edition CD, Instant Karma, the Amnesty International campaign to save Darfur, is at instantkarma.org/imagine. And from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, don't ask, don't tell, don't instant message. We meet Stephen Benjamin, who was discharged from his post as an Arabic translator for the Navy, when his chat messages to his former roommate that referred to being gay were monitored. Also, more with Tom Ricks, the Washington Post military correspondent, about the future of the U.S. military in Iraq. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Ricks, the military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, which will be published in paperback at the end of July. We've been talking about his latest trip to Iraq at the end of May, during which he interviewed military leaders about possible exit strategies. What's up with Surge? This was a controversial strategy, but it was put into effect. And now the news reports seem to be preparing us for a final report that say, well, it didn't work.
I think what you're getting at of General Petraeus and Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador in Iraq, is, look, fellas, we're not going to come back when we're scheduled to testify before the U.S. Congress in September. We're not going to come back and tell you it's working or it's not working. What we'll tell you is here's what we think we've done, and now you need to tell us where you want to go. And if you want to pull out, we can start talking about that. If you want to design a long-term presence, we can talk about that. But what they want to push the U.S. Congress into doing, I think, is debating the consequences of each of these possible courses of action. They don't want to debate about why we're in Iraq anymore. They're willing to concede, look, it was really badly done, a lot of this. But we're here now, and we're trying to figure out where we go from here. And you guys need to think about that as well in a realistic way. And I think they'll kind of push the burden of the debate back onto Congress rather than try to lay down solutions or defend the administration position. In many ways, what they're trying to do, I think, is push this debate beyond a President Bush popularity poll, which is where it seems to be stuck now. I'm pro-Bush, I'm pro-the war, I'm anti-Bush, I'm anti-the war. What they want is to say, look, Bush is almost becoming irrelevant to this equation. The next president's going to have to start making decisions. Let's start talking about those.
Peter Pace recently stepped down as the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What are some of the ways you've seen the military leadership change since Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld resigned? Like, what are some of the differences that you see in the new leadership?
Personally, what I've been kind of struck by is the number of guys who sidle up to me and say, hey, Tom, really like that book Fiasco. You know, I was kind of persona non grata under the Rumsfeld regime.
Uh-huh.
It's my understanding that I was banned from his plane for travel. When I signed up for Secretary Gates' first trip overseas when he took office last December, the clerk said to me, have you ever been traveling with the Secretary of Defense? And I said, well, yeah, about 30 times. They said, sir, we have no information on you in our computers, which meant that all the information on, you know, date of birth and Social Security and so on, had all been cleansed out of the official computer. I'd become like a non-person. So I'm a person again, which is nice.
So the way you're describing it, now that Rumsfeld's out and there's a new military leadership, a lot of these guys have not only read your book, they like your book Fiasco, which draws a terrible picture of how we handled Iraq. So where is Vice President Cheney in his relationship with this new military leadership that is critical of how we entered Iraq and wants to make sure we do a better job when we exit?
I wish I could do an imitation of Cheney like John Stewart does, that sort of curled lip, because that's the impression I have of Cheney at this point. You know, what's going on with those generals over there? Why are they all so critical? You know, what's the problem there? Can't somebody crack the whip here? I think the generals are kind of feeling at the Pentagon now like they have adult leadership for the first time in several years. Gates is a low-key man who listens a lot to people, who asks questions carefully without showing his hand, you know, without asking a question in such a way that it drives the answer. I think is very adept bureaucratically, but also can be quite cold-blooded in making decisions when he needs to. I mean, I was struck when he made the calculation that renominating General Pace as chairman of the Joint Chiefs for another two-year term would be difficult. He basically cut Pace loose very quickly. This was an extraordinary thing. This had never happened before. The two top officers in the U.S. military were effectively fired by Secretary Gates, but he did it in such a way, clearly, soberly, and I think fairly transparently, that he made it into a one-day story, which was quite artful. I actually thought this would be a bigger story than it was. Firing the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs simultaneously, who really were the last remnants of the Rumsfeld regime at the Pentagon. So I think Gates is showing an ability to listen, but also a strong hand, which is a combination the U.S. military really likes to have in civilian leaders at the top.
Mm-hmm. There was an article in the June edition of the Atlantic magazine called The Army We Have. This is an article about how the Army has basically lowered its standards for enlisting and made basic training easier because there's relatively few people who want to join the Army now. You've been covering the military for years, and you wrote a book all about the military. And what are your impressions? Do you think that the military has lowered its standards in order to get more recruits in?
I think there's no question that the Army has lowered its standards somewhat. The standards remain fairly high. They're nothing like they were in the late 70s when they really were taking anybody and people they knew were going to cause problems for them. The standards have gone down a bit. Oddly, where I pick up a lot of concern is not about boot camp. You know, questions about whether boot camp is hard enough will be with us always. There's an old joke about the Marine Corps, that the first guy joined the Marine Corps actually in Philadelphia in Tun's Tavern in 1775. And then when the second guy joined, the first guy said, well, it's not like the old Corps. So there's always those questions. The real concern I'm picking up in the U.S. military right now is about seasoned sergeants, what you call NCOs, guys who have 8 to 12 years in. And especially once you've got 12 years, it's fairly easy to do the next 8 and then retire with a full pension at 20 years. Now, if you join the military at, say, 19, that means you're on full retirement pay at 39 and you can begin another career. A lot of guys are saying, I'm not going to stick around for that. I've done, say, 10 years in. My wife has said it's either the Army or me, that I got to make a choice here. I'm on my third deployment to Iraq in the last 5 years. I'm getting out. Likewise, I picked up a lot of concern in Iraq on this trip about captains leaving, especially good, smart, experienced captains who have good job prospects in the outside world. I've been struck recently by the number of Iraq veterans I've come across who are now going to Harvard Business School. I think Harvard Business School has a real inclination to take in these people who have really been through a crucible of the spirit, are 29 years old, have led troops in combat, and are now saying, you know, I'd like to take my leadership skills and my knowledge of my own self and apply them in the business world. So while that may be good for American business, and I think it will be good to see more veterans going into politics, it's a huge concern right now, this exodus of captains and sergeants.
Later in our show today, we're going to be hearing from Stephen Benjamin, who was a translator in the Army, translating Arabic. He was based in the States, but translating information from Arabic and passing that on to troops in Iraq. He was discharged from the military because he had written in an email or in a group of emails about being gay, and the military leadership found that, and because of the don't ask, don't tell policy, they discharged him. So I guess my question to you is, what are your impressions of how the military leadership feels now about don't ask, don't tell? Do they feel it's working? Do they feel that it's worth losing the, like, 58 gay translators that have been discharged?
Well, remember, it's a huge U.S. military, so 58 to them is an insignificant number. I think the military generally feels that don't ask, don't tell is a good workable compromise that the bureaucracy especially feels comfortable with. Clearly, the people getting out or being kicked out do not feel comfortable with it, feel that there's no reason they should not be allowed to express themselves, especially if they follow military discipline in all other respects, like not fraternizing and so on. My concern is this. The best way to counter a roadside bomb, and that's the thing that causes most of our casualties in Iraq, the best way to counter a roadside bomb is not some high technology electronic jammer or overhead aircraft. The best way to counter a bomb is to speak Arabic, to be able to listen to people. Maybe they say it directly to you. Maybe they say it to each other as you're walking by. Maybe they say, boy, those troops are headed straight for that bomb that guy just planted. It would be nice to be able to hear that. Well, American troops don't speak Arabic. By kicking out people who speak Arabic, I think that some American casualties have directly resulted from that action. That if we have more people on the ground who speak Arabic, you are going to save more American lives. The second thing that really bothers me about this is you hear people say, well, maybe we should change the policy, but it's the wrong time to change the policy. You don't change the policy in the middle of a war. Well, that's just historically ignorant. The times when U.S. policies change tend to be in the middle of a war when manpower is most needed. So, for example, it was during the Korean War under Harry Truman when you had large-scale integration of black troops into formal out of segregated units in across the army, and everybody now agrees that was the right thing to do. It's wartime when policies tend to change, when you tend to get the most radical shifts in how we view gender, sexuality, and racial issues in the military.
When the United States went into Iraq, we were prepared. You know, our government prepared us for democracy in Iraq. We'd be liberators. Democracy would spread. And clearly, I mean, everybody agrees that scenario hasn't happened. You know, we've been talking during this interview about what the military thinks the strategy should be, what the kinds of things they're thinking of for the next few years. And they're thinking of an American military presence that would remain in Iraq for the next few years. What do you think is the best outcome we can hope for now in Iraq?
Iraq right now is essentially a failed state and one we helped create. Arguably a failed state under Saddam Hussein, but I think unarguably more of a failed state now. So what you can hope for probably is a lower level of violence. You're not going to get rid of it altogether. And Iraqis not reconciling, because I don't think that's going to happen, but at least accommodating each other, learning to live with each other. But this goes back to the risk-taking I was talking about earlier. We are preaching to Iraqis that you must somehow find a way of living with each other. But when I ask American generals about amnesties for insurgents who have killed American troops, their eyes get big and they say, no, I'd have a very hard time with that. Well, the fact of history is that insurgencies usually end with some sort of amnesty declaration. And so we're probably going to have to start practicing what we've been preaching to the Iraqis, which is swallowing hard and saying, yes, insurgents who have killed American troops are going to be covered by this amnesty declaration. And that's going to be a very tough hurdle for the American public to jump, but especially for American commanders who feel a sense of responsibility for their troops.
Tom Ricks, thanks so much for talking with us. It's really always good to talk with you. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. I love your show.
Tom Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post and the author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. It will be published in paperback at the end of July. Coming up, Stephen Benjamin, an Arabic translator for the Navy who was discharged because he's gay. This is Fresh Air. There's a shortage of military translators who know Arabic. One of the translators who's fluent in Arabic was discharged from the military in March because he's gay. Stephen Benjamin was a petty officer second class in the Navy, stationed in Fort Gordon, Georgia. He attended the Defense Language Institute, graduated in the top 10% of his class, and spent 2 years in the Navy as an Arabic translator. He violated Don't Ask, Don't Tell by instant messaging his former roommate, who's also gay, and was stationed in Iraq. The message, which made reference to their sexual orientation, was on the military's chat system. The system is monitored on government computers and randomly checked. After their message was read by inspectors, Benjamin was given an honorable discharge. His former roommate was allowed to finish his tour in Iraq before getting his honorable discharge.
Now, you were an interpreter of Arabic. You know, I've read that there's a shortage of Arabic interpreters. What could you say about that shortage from your perspective as a former interpreter?
There's definitely a huge shortage of Arabic linguists. I mean, pretty much everywhere in the military. It's incredibly useful to have someone who speaks Arabic out with units in Iraq, but generally they don't have someone. If they do, a lot of times it's a civilian contractor who incidentally are allowed to be gay, even though they're in a combat zone, because they're civilians. The military contracts out a lot of that also to Iraqi natives, but it's really hard finding people that they can trust, people that can hold a security clearance, and you know, people that can do the language work they need to. For Americans, it's really hard to learn the language. The Defense Language Institute has a pretty high attrition rate in the more difficult languages like Korean, Chinese, Arabic. And then a lot of people just, you know, barely make the minimum scores. So when they go out to their jobs, they might not be as effective as people who have higher language scores and higher language abilities. Condoleezza Rice came out a few months ago and was saying how much of a shortage the State Department has for Arabic linguists. It's government-wide. We don't have enough people to speak the language.
Do you think the military felt forced to discharge you because once your message was read and once you'd kind of outed yourself, do you think they felt like they had no choice?
I do think that. I know that at least at the local level, with my immediate superiors, nobody really wanted to lose me. And I know that at even higher levels in my command, I really don't think that, you know, this was the kind of thing that they wanted to be spending their time on. They didn't want to lose a sailor for a reason that's just, you know, not really legitimate. You have people who get kicked out of the military for doing drugs, or get DUIs, or can't meet the physical fitness standards, and then here they are kicking out two perfectly good Arabic translators without any disciplinary problems in the past. You know, they meet all the standards, and, you know, they're forced to kick us out.
I'm wondering why you even joined the military, knowing that you were expected to be closeted and that the military didn't really want gay people, if you interpret this policy at face value.
I had always loved languages. I took Spanish for 6 years, and after I graduated high school, I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, and you know, I knew the military had just a huge shortage of translators, so it seemed like a pretty good deal. I get to serve my country, they pay for me to go to school, and I get to learn something that I probably wouldn't be able to learn as fluently or as well as in the civilian world. So the don't ask, don't tell really didn't play into my decision. I didn't understand the policy completely when I joined. I thought it was, hey, you're not going to tell us, we're not going to ask, and we'll just leave it at that. We're not going to kick you out unless you come up to us and write a letter that says, hey, I'm gay, kick me out. And
that's you kind of did write a letter saying, hey, I'm gay. You wrote an email.
Effectively, but not with the intention of getting kicked out.
I see.
It's really hard to hide a personal life to people you spend your entire work day with and then go out to drink with. Everyone ends up finding out eventually. It's just unfortunate that the wrong people found out.
So in terms of don't ask, don't tell, how don't tell were you?
As far as don't tell, when I first joined, I was pretty paranoid. I just didn't tell anyone. I kept to myself. And then once I finally got to Georgia, which was my duty station after my training, I met a lot more gay people, and I met a lot of friends. And, you know, we all hung out together, and it's kind of hard to hide that. And it was never a big deal. No one ever cared. So I guess I kind of just fell into that and just got lax with, you know, which people I told or which people I didn't guard myself as much.
Obviously, you want to get the don't ask, don't tell policy changed, and you'd like to see gays accepted on an equal footing in the military. What do you think it would take to change the policy?
I think there's plenty of support in Congress right now. There's 126 co-sponsors on a bill that's pretty much sat untouched for 2 years, basically because the chairman of the Armed Services Committee won't bring it to hearing. But a lot of that is because Congress defers to the military on military matters. I mean, which makes sense. A Harvard Law graduate isn't really going to know too much about the actual logistics of running a war. So I think it's going to take people like Admiral Mullen, when he takes over as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and other chiefs of the services to come out and say, hey, we can make this work. And I think they need to talk to the troops actually on the ground, because the vast majority of them are comfortable serving with gays. And things are a lot different than they were in 1994. Once that happens, I think Congress will be a lot more open to passing the law to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
If you weren't discharged because the military discovered you were gay, would you have wanted to continue to serve?
I would have finished my enlistment. I was getting ready to re-enlist as well for another 4 years. I'm not sure if I would have stayed in past that. I think that if the policy stayed in effect, it's really taxing to be gay for many, many years in the military. I would imagine most gay people who don't get kicked out don't usually re-enlist. So that's another huge number of people that the military is losing every year because of this policy that goes uncounted.
My guest is Stephen Benjamin. He was an Arabic translator in the Navy. He was discharged from the Navy in March because he's gay. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Benjamin. He was an Arabic translator in the Navy. He was discharged in March because he's gay. He was outed when he used the military's instant messaging system to chat with his former roommate, who's also gay, and was stationed in Iraq. The messaging system is monitored by the military and randomly checked. Now, the way you've described it, you were part of a circle of gay people where you were stationed who hung out together and who kept each other's secret. So now that you're out, does that mean they've been outed too? Do you know what I mean? That does it become clear that they're gay because you were part of that circle? And are they worried now about getting discharged themselves?
The group I was in was kind of interesting because most of us were out to our peers in our offices for the most part. And there were plenty of straight people in our group as well. So I don't necessarily think an association with me means, oh, hey, that person might be gay. But rumors aren't enough under the policy, usually, to kick someone out. I mean, that's not really stopping someone's command from going to check out their MySpace profile to see who their friends are, or, just starting an impromptu kind of under-the-table investigation. But I don't really see that happening, because for the most part, people, or the senior leadership, don't want to kick people out under this policy. But they're still kicking out two or three a day, military-wide, because they're forced to.
Is there a whole code that gay people speak in the military so that they can talk about being gay without using the word gay and without, therefore, violating policy in an overt way?
We use the word family to describe ourselves. Is he family? That kind of thing. It's kind of amusing because we really were family. I mean, they're some of the closest people. Some of the closest relationships I've ever had were in the military.
Were you screened in any way for homosexuality when you joined the military? Are you asked if you're straight or gay?
The law actually, the don't ask part of that law, the only point...
Of course, they can't ask, right.
They can actually ask. The only thing the law prohibits is that they can't ask when you're recruited. Uh-huh. The only thing you're handed is a statement. It's mixed in with a whole bunch of other recruiting documents. And it just says, I understand the military's policy on homosexuals. And you just put a little X by it.
I don't know if your parents are alive, but if they are, were you out to them when all of this happened with the military?
I was not. I was not out to them before I got kicked out.
What a way to be outed to your parents.
I did tell them before the first media stories hit, and I talked to them about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're adjusting pretty well. But it's definitely a lot to drop on them. Hey, I'm not in the military, and by the way, I'm gay. That's kind of a huge thing to drop on someone. And by the way, watch me on CNN next week. You know, that's that you know.
But they're handling that okay?
They're handling it okay. You know, now they're like, oh, let us know when you're going to be on TV again, or hey, are you in the newspaper this week?
Why did you feel like you couldn't tell them before?
I grew up as a conservative evangelical. My parents are as well. So it was told my whole life that being gay was wrong, and I struggled with that for a long time, especially when they tell you you can change. And, you know, a decade later, I realized that's not going to happen. But it was still difficult to tell them because I knew what they believed, and I really didn't want to challenge their beliefs. It took me a long time to realize who I was, and I didn't want to think about what it would take or what they would be feeling when I told them.
You know, it must be hard to go from a climate where you're brought up thinking that homosexuality is really bad and that it's within your power to become straight, and then to decide that you disagree with that, but then you end up in the military where, you know, the climate is, well, if you're gay, don't let us know, because if you let us know, you're out of here. I mean, because, yeah. Again, it's such a kind of anti-gay ethos.
It actually wasn't that difficult, because it wasn't really a change from what I was used to. I really didn't come out until after I joined the military. I was still pretty closeted beforehand. Only a few friends knew. So it really wasn't a huge change in the way, you know, I went about my life, because I was closeted when I was out of, before I was in the military, and then it was just stayed there.
So this really is a big change for you now, huh?
It is a pretty huge change. It's hard getting used to all the attention and knowing that I'm out to everyone. Pretty much, I'm, you know, it's really, you type my name into Google, first couple of results that come up, and, you know, it's obvious that I'm gay for the rest of my life and it follows me. But I think I made the right decision, and I think I really hope that I'm making a difference, at least changing some minds out there.
Well, Stephen Benjamin, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Stephen Benjamin worked in the Navy as an Arabic translator before being honorably discharged in March because he's gay. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross, reminding you, you can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. From Fox Searchlight, presenting Waitress, an uplifting comedy by Adrienne Shelley about a small-town girl with big dreams, now playing in select theaters. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the split in the Bush administration over Iran, regime change versus behavior change. We talk with journalist Laura Rosen. She writes about national security for the American Prospect and is a contributor to the Washington Monthly. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.